Listen local.
For Radio Catskill, this is Rosie Starr. Welcome to Farm and Country, locally produced radio about rural life in the Catskills and the Delaware River Valley. On today's show, community member Steve Schwartz encourages us to attend this year's 2024 BioBlitz science event on June 29th on the grounds of the Highlights Foundation in Boyd's Mill, Wayne County, Pennsylvania. Stephanie Phillips finalizes her conversation with Iris Van Gillingham from Gale Roots Community Farm in Livingston Manor, New York. In this segment, Now You Know, we'll hear about core values, land stewardship, and the aspects of nonprofit education. All of that and Keith Hubbard's Star Talk report coming up on today's Farm and Country after news headlines from NPR.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Giles Snyder. Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas is warning that climate change is making weather events more extreme.
This is a tremendous force in the world right now, not just, of course, domestically, but internationally. And we have to be ready for its consequences. Those consequences are not diminishing nor plateauing. They are only increasing.
Mayorkas spoke to reporters while visiting the Federal Emergency Management Agency for a briefing about the wildfire and hurricane seasons. Experts are predicting a busy storm season as extreme heat is expected to break records in parts of the country this weekend. In New Mexico, heavy rain is helping to slow a deadly wildfire burning south of Albuquerque, but the region is now dealing with flooding. New Mexico officials ordered mandatory evacuations last night. Flood watch is also up for parts of Iowa, Wisconsin, and Michigan today. More than 100 million people across the U.S. currently under heat warnings, and data from hospitals around the country show that heat is sending people to the emergency room. NPR's Alejandro Barondo looks at parts of the Midwest and Northeast, regions not accustomed to sweltering temperatures.
Emergency room doctors know that when the heat comes, so do the patients. Many show up with heat illness or heat stroke. Others have existing health problems that flare up when they get too hot. Heat stresses people's hearts, so there are more heart attacks. It worsens air quality, so respiratory issues spring up. According to the CDC, over the last 5 years, ERs in Midwest states like Michigan and Wisconsin would see on average about 350 patients for every 100,000 admissions. In recent days, though, that number was nearly double. Emergency calls are also way up in New Hampshire, Vermont, and Maine. Climate change intensifies and lengthens heat waves. Alejandra Barunda, NPR News.
To Texas now, which has a near-total abortion ban with exceptions only to preserve a pregnant person's life or a major bodily function. Olivia Aldridge from member station KUT reports the Texas Medical Board has just released new guidance which tries to clarify what that means for doctors.
The medical board's new rule mostly focuses on how doctors should document what factored into their decision to perform an emergency abortion in case the procedure is investigated. But board president Sheriff Safran acknowledged it's still a doctor's subjective medical judgment that will have to pass muster.
What is black and white are the exceptions. What is gray is the medical judgment. And that's why we're sitting here.
Physicians have reported feeling uncertain about what circumstances are considered life-threatening under Texas law. Doctors who perform an illegal abortion can face prison time, fines, and the loss of their medical license. For NPR News, I'm Olivia Aldridge in Austin.
And you're listening to NPR News.
Support comes from Damascus Citizens for Sustainability, fighting for clean air, land, and water since 2008, both locally and beyond. Information online at their Main Street storefront in Narrowsburg or their office in the Narrowsburg Union. DamascusCitizens.org.
Welcome back to Farm and Country. I'm your host, Rosie Starr. Coming up on today's show, community member Steve Schwartz encourages us to attend this year's 2024 BioBlitz science event on June 29th on the grounds of the Highlights Foundation in Boyd's Mill, Wayne County, Pennsylvania. Stephanie Phillips finalizes her conversation with Iris Van Gillingham from Gale Roots Community Farm in Livingston Manor, New York. In this segment, Now You Know, we'll hear about core values, land stewardship, and the aspects of nonprofit education. First, here is Keith Hubbard's Star Talk report. Thank you for joining us on Radio Catskill for this week's locally produced Farm and Country.
For Farm and Country, I'm Keith Hubbard, and this is Star Talk. One of the most awe-inspiring sights in the night sky is the Aurora Borealis, more commonly known as the Northern Lights. These wispy ribbons of light can seem to dance across the sky at northern latitudes. They are frequently seen at about 70 degrees latitude and higher. During periods of heightened solar activity, it is possible to see the Northern Lights at locations in the contiguous United States. The Northern Lights are the result of the interaction of charged particles emitted by the Sun's corona and Earth's magnetic field, which deflects the particles toward Earth's magnetic poles. Along their journey along Earth's magnetic field, the particles interact with the atmosphere as well as the molecules within the atmosphere to determine the color of the aurora. The most common aurora color is green. Green auroras are produced when particles interact with oxygen molecules at an altitude between 60 and 190 miles. Red auroras are produced when particles interact with oxygen molecules at higher altitudes, around 180 to 250 miles. Lower latitudes see red northern lights because they occur at higher altitudes and can be seen further from the poles. Blue and purple auroras are less common and are produced when particles interact with nitrogen at an altitude of 60 miles or less. The least common color auroras are yellow and pink. These occur during periods of high solar activity and are a mixture of red auroras with green or blue auroras. If you have any questions, comments, or ideas for future Star Talk segments, my email address is startalk@farmandcountry.org. For Farm and Country and Star Talk, this has been Keith Hubbard, reminding you to keep looking up.
A BioBlitz is a communal citizen science effort to record as many species within a designated location and time period as possible. Here is community member Steve Schwartz to give us a primer on this year's BioBlitz.
This year, the BioBlitz will happen June 28th and 29th at the Highlights Foundation Retreat Center in Boyd's Mills. The eight teams of scientists and amateur naturalists gather on the 28th to begin collecting, identifying, and cataloging every single living species they can find visible to the naked eye. And they'll start at noon on the 28th and continue through the night to noon on June 29th. On the 29th, Saturday, June 29th, the public is invited from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. to meet the scientists, to see what they've collected, to see the critters, and to learn a little bit more about them, look through microscopes, look at fish tanks, and also to enjoy a range of activities and programs that we will assemble for them. There will be walks and workshops and talks about foraging, about native plants, about amphibians and reptiles and insects. And there will also be art and performance and music and theater, because we want to get kids excited about science in ways that may be not just talking to the scientists, but also learning a little bit more about how they think and approach the world. I love the BioBlitz because it is a way for kids to learn about science and learn that science is long and hard, but it's good and fun. And the way you learn is being out there in the world, in the woods, in the meadows, and observing. And that's exactly what scientists do. And they come from as far away as Philadelphia and Pittsburgh and State College and Ithaca and New York City. And many of them are repeats over the last five BioBlitzes because they find that it's fun to gather with fellow scientists from other disciplines. And they also love meeting the public. They love meeting people and explaining what they do. So we're excited. It will be the first public BioBlitz since 2018, and it's a great site, and we hope you can come out and enjoy it.
What I love about the BioBlitz is that it's the public engages with their environment while generating useful data for science and conservation. Folks are outdoors, and it's fun for all ages. How did highlights become the choice of 2024 BioBlitz?
We had a few sites under consideration, and we assembled a team of the scientists to go out and do a field visit at the sites. And they were impressed with both sites. They chose the Highlights Foundation site because it represents what we believe will be a good set of habitats and biodiversity. So it has woods, it has both hemlock and deciduous hardwoods, it has open areas, it has streams, it has wet areas, it has wet meadows. You know, you need an assortment of types of habitat to find as many creatures as you can. To give you an example, our BioBlitzes in the past, we have found as many as, or even more than 1,000 unique species in 24 hours. One of the fun things about it is that these scientists will then identify stuff and catalog it. But they'll also look at publicly accessible databases to see if it's been identified in Wayne County in the past. And over the course of our 5 previous BioBlitzes, we have found probably well over 200 species that had never been recorded in Wayne County. It's not to say that anything we find is going to be unique or that we'll find new species or whatever, but the field science hasn't been done in Wayne County too much. And if it has been done, it may sit in somebody's drawer and has never been published. So we love to get this information out on the public record to use for us as we go about understanding how to best manage our habitats, and also for the future to see if there's change.
Where can folks get more information on how to sign up for this?
The BioBlitz is a free event on the public day, June 29th, from 10 to 4. You're welcome to come out to the site. There will be information on getting to the site and about the program and schedule on the website, which is upperdelawarebioblitz.com. And there's also a pretty active Facebook and Instagram page for the Upper Delaware BioBlitz, which may end up having even more current information the day of. We're always happy to get people involved who have any particular expertise as volunteers. Some of the teams are pretty filled up, but if you have particular expertise in bird watching or in moss and lichen identification, I know those are two of the areas that we're still open. And we're also soliciting donations for the BioBlitz. There is a donation page set up by our fiscal sponsor, the Wayne County Community Foundation, where you can go and make a donation to the event. And I'd also love to recognize some of our lead sponsors, which include the Upper Delaware Council, the Wayne Conservation District, and the Friends of the Upper Delaware River.
It sounds like an honorable effort. I look forward to it, and I appreciate you taking the time to speak with us. It's nice to have community members that highlight the Upper Delaware River Valley. It's such a beautiful place. Before we close, is there anything else you'd like to add?
I love, Rosie, that you love to highlight the Upper Delaware River, as many of us do. And we love where we live, and we love the people that live here. And that's what makes it a great place. Thanks, Rosie.
That was community member Steve Schwartz on the 2024 Upper Delaware BioBlitz, to be held on June 28th and 29th at the Highlights Foundation Retreat Center in Boyd's Mills, Wayne County, Pennsylvania. More information is available online, upperdelawarebioblitz.com. The Upper Delaware BioBlitz Instagram and Facebook has up-to-date information.
Good morning. This is Stephanie Phillips with Now You Know for Farm and Country. Today I'm visiting Gail Root's farm in Livingston Manor. I'll be speaking with Iris Fenn Gillingham, who founded and runs Gail Root's farm. Iris, you seem to have relationships with a number of different organizations. Exactly what's your relationship with Catskill Mountain Keeper?
Catskill Mountain Keeper is a supporter of ours, and we're really, really grateful for their support as we get started. We incorporated as a community farm that is going to be its own 501c3 eventually, but in the meantime, Catskill Mountain Keeper is acting as our fiscal sponsor so that we are eligible for grants and so that we can do the work that we want to do and have some of the funding that we need to have access to in order to do the educational programming that is in our mission.
You talk about the educational aspect of the Gail Root's farm, but exactly how do you do that education? Do you have exams? Do you have grades? Do you have classroom teaching? Or is it all kind of informal?
All of the teaching that we do on the farm is based in hands-on experiences. And so we have multiple programs running this year. One of our programs that we're doing is a collaboration with Livingston Manor Central School, where we will be having the summer school kids on the farm every week. We did this last year, and I've worked with the summer school for a couple years now. This gives the opportunity for the kids to spend time outdoors on the farm, learning hands-on. So we basically, it's like taking a science class, but the classroom is the garden and the woods. We learn about all sorts of things relating to soil health, to ecology, to environmental sciences, and then we also learn about animal husbandry. We teach them about the region, the watershed, all these different things, but they get to do it on the land, outside, and really use a lot of their senses. So it's not just a textbook experience. We also have our Black Mesa to Catskills Exchange, which includes older folks and our farm interns. And that's an experience for people who are like out of high school, and they're getting to learn about food sovereignty and food systems and agriculture in multiple locations. So both here in the Catskill Mountains and on the Navajo Reservation in Arizona in the desert, which is such a different environment. And so both of those things that we're doing are hands-on, are based in education as the core value, but hands-on. It goes much deeper than a textbook or an article or something you can talk about in the classroom, because it gives kids and any participants in the programs a deeper understanding of agriculture, a deeper understanding of what we're talking about when we talk about growing food, when we talk about working with the land and land stewardship. And they're skills that everyone, I think, has an interest in a lot of times, but doesn't necessarily know how to go about it. Getting folks on the land is educational in and of itself, and then we just take it farther by talking about what we can share and really diving deeper.
But you don't actually have classroom learning.
Well, we don't have a classroom. We just do all of the learning experiences outside on the farm.
You mentioned the Black Mesa to Catskills Exchange. How does that work?
That came out of a relationship that I had with one of our previous interns on Wild Roots Farm, Annie. She's from Black Mesa. She had an amazing experience working on the farm with me. We talked about sharing some of the things that we've been learning with other young people and really tapping into both of our respective communities as a learning experience. So we actually ended up getting a grant to implement a program, and we will be having three young people coming out and spending a month here on Gail Root's Community Farm. And then we'll be going out to Black Mesa for a week or so. And in both places, all the participants of the program will really get to dive into agriculture and food systems and philosophical conversations about that, as well as hands-on skill building. We'll go visit other local farms in the region. We will be planting, harvesting, growing, working with animals, so doing animal husbandry. And then we'll be doing both those things in both locations. It will be building skills and enhancing the understanding that the young people have for both how they can engage more in their own communities with these elements, but also their confidence in being able to go back out into the world and share what they're learning.
Sounds like an amazing experience. You also seem to have some collaboration with Catskill Art Space. What's that about?
We started collaborating with Catskill Art Space last year to host the first Fiber Arts Residency. We're doing it again this year, and that is an opportunity for a fiber artist to actually come and spend a week on the farm doing their craft and exploring fiber arts in a place where they can get to know the sheep, where the wool comes from, where they can go out and harvest the flowers that they can use to dye for their weavings. And last year we had Sophie, our fiber artist in residence, and she was able to go out and collect all of this goldenrod and marigolds and Dyer's coreopsis, and she dyed yarn and she wove it and she made a beautiful piece. It's an opportunity for a fiber artist to really connect and dive deeper into their craft in a place where they're not going to a yarn store to get the yarn. They're actually getting to see the sheep and the land where they are then being able to process the yarn and make it into something creative and beautiful and artistic.
Do you have spinning wheels? How do you make the sheep wool into yarn?
Yeah, we do hand spinning and weaving and natural dyeing all here on the farm. We actually have a little fiber arts studio on the side of Gilroot's house, and we are right now, there's a giant felted piece that we have out on the table. Some folks were in there, some neighbors were in there the other day making felt hats. And Icelandic sheep, which are what we have on the farm, their wool is really amazing for felting. So we also make felt balls with the kids at the local school. We have a couple looms in that room as well, so that we do weaving. And my mom actually does spinning lessons for folks who are interested in learning about hand spinning. So there's a lot of fiber arts work that we do here, and we want to foster that more in our local community as well. Wool is amazing, and we are super, super grateful to have an abundance of it with the sheep. We also have fiber flax that we started growing, and that is what linen is made out of. So I've been exploring the process of creating flax into linen. And that's a whole other process because it's actually a plant fiber. So it's a plant that's grown on the farm, and then it is retted and processed and made into yarn.
The wool that you make here and dye here, how does it hold up? Do the colors fade more than they would with the commercially produced wool?
With natural dyeing, it all depends on a lot of factors. So one of the factors is the mordant that you use. Having a mordant can really help the dye stick, and so that it doesn't wash out when you go to wash your shirt. It's really beautiful, too, to work with natural dyes because the color can change so much based on the mordant you use and based on the timing that you harvest the flowers. So, like, for example, the first week that goldenrod is blooming, if you harvest the flowers and dye with it, then it will be a slightly different color yellow than if you harvest the goldenrod a couple weeks later. In general, natural dyes, if they are bleached and or left entirely out in the sun for long, long periods of time, they can fade like anything, but most natural dyes have an incredible vibrancy, and you can really play so much with the natural dyes because there's so many variations, and it's more like a creative process than just a boxed chemical dye that you get from the store. And you're using things from the land as well, so you're not using chemicals. It's a chemistry process with plants, basically, which is really amazing. There are tons and tons of natural colors here in the Catskills, just from black walnut hulls to all the flowers to all of the roots that you can use. My mom grows some indigo. One of the things I'm hoping to plant this year or next year is a bunch of madder, because madder root makes a really beautiful orange, orange reddish color that I love. And yeah, so there's so much flexibility and creativity that comes with natural dyes. We're so lucky that all these natural dyes are right here in our backyard.
What exactly is a mordant? Is it something that you can also get naturally?
So a mordant is basically what binds the color to the fiber. There are many different kinds of mordant. You can use like pieces of iron, like a cast iron pan, which can be used as a mordant. You can use alum or copper or all sorts of things. A lot of times it's a mineral, so it's basically like chemistry. It's a chemistry lab in a way. But basically what it does is it helps the yarn to bond with the color, and so it doesn't wash out. There are certain things that have natural mordants. So for example, like if we dyed a bunch of stuff this fall with black walnut hulls, you don't need a mordant for that because it's such a strong dye already. So it all depends on the plant itself, and that's where you can get really creative, is every plant is different and every shade of color that you want to get will change based on what mordant you choose to use.
I'm trying to picture this. You're putting your dye in and you're putting a frying pan in there along with it?
Well, it all depends on how you use the iron. Some people do it in a cast iron dye pot. Some people will use old nails. You can use pieces of metal. Iron is just one of the many mordants you can use. A lot of people, I think, buy mordants, the powdered mordants that you can put in. But there's also ways that you can use your own mordants with things around you, like old nails and railroad ties or things like that.
How do you advertise? How do you get artists and beginner farmers to come to your programs?
A lot of people find us and hear about us through our reputation or through social media. We often have a lot of people who just hear about us through places and reach out. You know, we have a website and an Instagram and Facebook.
Well, if somebody actually wants to enroll in one of your programs, where will they find you?
To learn more about our programs, they can go to our website, which is www.galerootsfarm.org. And then we are also very active on social media, so on Instagram or Facebook. We post a lot about our programs. We post about what we're up to. We will be hosting our fiber arts residency in September, the first week of September. And then we will be doing the fiber artist, who is going to be spending a week at Gale Roots Community Farm, will be doing a talk at Catskill Art Space at the end of their fiber arts residency.
So now you know a little bit about living in harmony with the land. Our expert farmer today has been Iris Fenn Gillingham, who's the manager of Gale Roots Community Farm in Livingston Manor. If you know a local expert for me to interview, email me at stephanie@wjffradio.org. This has been Stephanie Phillips for Farm and Country.
We hope that you enjoyed our show this week, with production by Radio Catskill volunteers Keith Hubbard and Stephanie Phillips. Special thanks goes to our guests, community member Steve Schwartz and Iris Fenn Gillingham from Gale Roots Community Farm in Livingston Manor, New York. This has been your host, Rosie Starr. Thanks for listening local to Farm and Country and supporting Radio Catskill.
Support comes from Damascus Citizens for Sustainability, fighting for clean air, land, and water since 2008, both locally and beyond. Information online at their Main Street storefront in Narrowsburg or their office in the Narrowsburg Union. DamascusCitizens.org.
Can two people with different political beliefs still have a meaningful conversation? I'm Ronald Kelson, and I'm working with Radio Catskill on StoryCorps' One Small Step, bringing strangers and our community together, one conversation at a time. We are having conversations in the Catskills and Northeast Pennsylvania all year long, and you should be a part of it. Sign up now at wjffradio.org.
StoryCorps' One Small Step and the radio station hubs are made possible by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.